live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we're going to explore how the omega-3 fatty acids can improve your memory, what happens when you have bad bacteria in your body, and also we're going to look at the nutrients that can prolong our lifespan and repair our DNA. Health and nutrition, lots of it. From our environmental segment, a commentary about what's going on this week in Rio de Janeiro. From The Guardian, George Montabaud, about how all of our world leaders, and I mean all of them, sold us all out. So what really goes on at these summits? The environment? Plans to lessen global warming? Not at all. That'll be an interesting commentary. If we have time today, I will share how our drug-driven medicine becomes a form of human sacrifice. I will start today by reading a letter from one of our audience. I will have another person, a former producer of mine, on tomorrow talking about how, had she not intervened this week, her mother would be dead, and how there was utter indifference on the part of the doctors, nurses, the emergency room, about what happened, and that this goes on every day. It's time that we threw a spotlight on it. So a short segment each day about how we can regain a sense of healing through our medical paradigm instead of killing, maiming, injuring. Time permitting, and I'm not sure we'll have time, but if we don't, we'll get to it on an upcoming show. I've decided to address something that occurred while I was en route on a trip, and a person came over in the airport and said, I listened to you on KPFK, our sister station in Los Angeles, in fact, where I did my overnight show early this morning for 6 hours and a half for nearly 30 years. And the person made an interesting comment, said, I really don't see any proof that America is losing its freedoms. People can protest. They can vote for who they want to. I don't see the militarization of our police. Why don't you give some evidence? All right, today, the hard evidence that we are not becoming a police state, we are a police state. And we have fascism, and it's running rampant. From Jane Nesselrode, from Op-Ed Nuge, the news, the NDAA is worse than we thought, and coup of 2012, the encroachment upon basic freedoms, militarized police state in America, from Frank Morales. We have a lot to share, but we also have a guest today, and it will be the beginning of a series, and that will be a series of looking at the so-called official stories. You've heard me in the last 3 months on many occasions state that the only truth we're allowed is an official truth. The only people we're allowed to trust or believe in are those who come from their official positions, the Council on Foreign Relations, and who are the top of the food chain at The Nation magazine, therefore representing the official corporate left and Democratic Party. Those on the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberg Group, those that run think tanks left and right, all of whom are beholden to whom? You don't know? Well, we're going to find out. Today, Liam Sheff, an award-winning investigative journalist, will talk about the medical cult and the politics of science, looking at everything from the official point of view and showing how none of it is accurate, but we're led to believe it is. This is going to be an interesting discussion. Because he has so many topics, I'm choosing only one today. And we'll show you in our next segment how what we're taught officially, that all the media left and right accepts without challenge, is wrong. I mean, always wrong. Not sometimes, not occasionally, always. And we're going to call them out. So as you see, we have a lot to share. Let's begin. Oh, and by the way, I was asked this morning, what do I believe of the stop and frisk, search and frisk? Well, I'm not going to tell you. We're going to let Columbo tell you, or, you know, the character in the television series, Columbo. This time it's going to be through the voice of Randy Cretico. Columbo is going to tell you about the stop and frisk, the search and frisk in New York and elsewhere. The omega-3 fatty acids, something we all need. Now, as a vegan, I can get mine through flaxseed oil and avocados and walnuts and other nutrient foods. But for the average person, it's going to be fish oil. This is from the Cochrane Group, which is one of the most respected independent scientific organizations in the world. They say, quote, older people who take omega-3 fish oil supplements are not only reducing their chances of cognition, but substantially so. That's based upon looking at all the data. And they're saying that if you take them for more than 3.5 years, you really see the benefit. So that's just a heads up. Whether it's from seeds and nuts, sunflower seeds, pumpkin seeds, sesame seeds, almonds, walnuts, macadamias, cashews, raw, good, take them, or fish oil, you're going to have your memory longer, and that's important. Our body has more bacteria than cells. By sometimes an estimate from 10 times, which would put it at like 10 trillion to 100 times. Depending upon what we think and how we process information, what we eat and what we drink, we can either have a predominance of good bacteria or harmful bacteria. But both reside all the time. For example, if you were to stop every single person in Manhattan today and took a swab from their throat and cultured it, you would find that probably 95% have either staph or strep or both. And yet, most won't have a staph infection or a strep throat. Why not? Because 24/7 your body's immune system is fighting on your behalf to maintain the upper hand. Now, when you get stressed and you overwork or you overtrain or you don't get enough sleep or you have some environmental exposure or you drink, you throw the body's out of balance. Sugar throws it out of balance. Soft drinks out of balance. Here's the latest medical news today from Nature magazine, the most respected scientific publication in the world. I'll quote it verbatim. Science working on a huge project that has mapped all the different microbes that live in and on the healthy human body have made a number of remarkable discoveries, including the fact that harmful bacteria can live in healthy bodies and coexist with their host and other microbes without causing disease. And then it goes on to talk about how this happens. Well, you've known that for a long time. And one of the reasons that we should be detoxing daily, and every time you have a green juice or a powder that is rich in chlorophyll and phytonutrients, you are detoxing. You are chelating out heavy metals. And when that juice happens to have some chlorophyll in it from, let's say, spirulina, wheatgrass juice, chlorella, then you're getting the real heavy bad characters, aluminum, cadmium, mercury, out of the body. When you take good probiotics 2 or 3 times a day, 5 to 20 billion, you're recolonizing by an enormous advantage the good bacteria. So the battle swings to your side. When you eat sugar or caffeinated beverages or alcohol in any amount, the battle swings against you. But this is a battle that happens in microseconds. So let's say tonight you go out and you drink more than you should. You eat a big fat meal. You top it off with a dessert that's made with white flour and dairy from growth-stimulating hormones. And you have lots of sugar. And then you get home and you have to take an antacid. You really don't feel that good. And what does an antacid do? It's simple. It turns off hydrochloric acid, brings it way down. Well, how far down? Oh, so far that the food then is dumped, and hence the dumping sensation, which is an epidemic and has been for a long time in America. The food can no longer digest properly because you've turned off the acid. And then when you turn off the acid, it has no place to go. It can't just sit there, so the little tiny flap opens, It's called the pyloric sphincter flap, and then the food goes into the top 12 inches of the intestine. You can either call it the duodenum or duodenum, and then it goes through the jejunum and other parts of your intestine. But wasn't the whole purpose of eating a meal to have all that broken down and hydrolyzed to about the consistency of a thick soup? Yeah. And isn't that what we call going from bolus to chyme? C-H-Y-M-E? And B-O-L-U-S? Yes. And isn't the whole purpose of this exercise to take the nutrients from this chymy soup in our intestine and have that absorbed through the hundreds of millions of tiny little villi that are hanging from the roof of the intestine, and so our nutrients are absorbed up through there into the bloodstream, through the liver, metabolized, sent out to the cells, nourish the cells? That's correct. Well, then exactly how do we get any nutrition out of a meal that hasn't been fully digested, has been suspended, and then all of that, including large particulate matter, just dumped in the intestine? Now you get it, you don't. But at least you don't have indigestion. So you can watch the commercial that says, eat that big sandwich, eat that big pizza, have that hot pepper. But don't worry, when you get that acid indigestion, all you have to do is just take this and it goes away. Well, so does your nutrition. The bioavailability of the nutrition, the digestibility of that nutrition. You end up malnourished and all that. Oh, and did we forget that because these are such large particles of undigested food going in the intestine, these might actually penetrate through the intestinal barrier and get into the bloodstream through what we call leaky gut syndrome, and that causes a whole cascade of allergic reactions? Yeah, that can happen too. And then you have allergic reactions and swelling in your arms and your calves and in your ankles and your wrists and your fingers and bloating in the face. So there's only two ways of looking at this. Your body will fight on your behalf without ever doing anything but honoring you, irrespective of the bad choices you make, until it can no longer defend you and it tips. At the point of a tipping, you'll notice a symptom. It might be a heart attack, a stroke, a small tumor, maybe aches and pains, inflammation, but bacteria are crucial to this whole effort. So the more good food, living food, raw food, clean food, healthy food, organic food that you put into your system, and juices and compounding powders and nutrients, hence you, in effect, are living a healthy, positive bacteria life. And you will live a longer life, and you will have less disease than someone else. And we can show you whole populations where this is true. The evidence is overwhelming. We don't need any more evidence about this. We have plenty. All we have to do is just pay attention. Think of those people who are eating in South Korea their fermented cabbages and pickles. Think of the Germans that were eating, in Bavaria especially, that were eating krauts. They had over 50 different types of krauts, not just a regular sauerkraut. All that has living bacteria. Think of those that were drinking the different fermented teas out of Japan, eating the nano misos. Those are positive bacteria. Tempeh, positive bacteria. It's almost all bacteria. All good for you. Good foods, good bacteria. Bad foods, bad bacteria. At the end of the day, your disease will happen because you tip the scale between good and bad bacteria. And finally, and none of that is that challenging, it's all relatively simple. Even with a kid with a fever, start giving him nutrients that are rich in teas and soups that are good and good bacteria and antioxidants, and wow, what a difference it makes. Now there's a new study reported in the National Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Hence, it no longer is really up for debate, because once they offer a definitive position paper, it then is accepted. That doesn't mean it's applied, just accepted. But for decades, it wasn't. When you mentioned meditation, they said, yeah, meditation, so what? And we were saying, well, meditation's very positive. They were saying, well, there's no scientific proof. Now there is. From Science Daily, the official paper of science, a Texas Tech University research project has found that meditation increases the dynamic of white matter in the brain and surrounding the nerves that are protective to that tissue, expansion of the myelin, and especially in the brain's anterior cingulate region. In lay language, when you meditate, just on being present, just sit someplace and relax and just be present for what's around you. That's all meditation is, mindfulness. You actually help double up on the positive benefits of new white matter, so you're growing a younger, more healthy, and vital brain. I'm Gary Noll. We're here to share insights. Two quick commentaries before we go to our guest. This is from David Swanson and from countercurrents.org, and it says the following. The title is Kleptomilitary Dictatorships. It's short, but I think deserves a word. Which came first, the oil business or the war machine that protects it? Who started this madness, the military that consumes so much of the oil or the corporations that distribute and profit from the filthy stuff? An answer of sorts can be found in Timothy Mitchell's book, Carbon Democracy, Political Power in the Age of Oil. Western oil corporations were never strong enough, Mitchell finds, to monopolize the flow or stoppage of Middle Eastern oil without a major military and financial assistance. So they began talking about their control of the Middle Eastern oil as being an imperial interest. When imperial went out of fashion, the phrase shifted to strategic interest. Early in the 20th century, the Anglo-Persian Oil Company discovered that its oil stank. It contained high levels of sulfur, and people wouldn't burn it for illumination. So the oil company enlisted the British Navy as a customer. In fact, it pretended the Navy was a major customer for a few years until it actually became one. The British Empire thus developed an interest in protecting the company's control of the oil of what is now Iran in order to fuel the new ships of the Navy, a Navy designed to protect Britain's imperial interest. The Royal Navy had another reason for shifting to oil-burning ships. According to Mitchell, coal miners were developing the annoying habit of going on strike, effectively flicking off the light switch on the empire and all its toys. Coal mining involved more workers than oil drilling, and the movement of the coal, once mined, was more easily blocked en route. Coal and the ease with which it could be sabotaged was a driver of democracy, whereas oil would be its enemy. In 1920, Winston Churchill proposed winning hearts and minds in what is now Iraq by bombing the place, to which the British Secretary of State for War objected thus, quote, "If the Arab population realize that the peaceful control of Mesopotamia ultimately depends on our intention of bombing women and children, I am very doubtful if we shall gain the acquiescence of the fathers and husbands," end quote. Well, such logic would no more stop Winston Churchill than it would Barack Obama. Come the Second World War, and it was the turn of the U.S. oil companies to win subsidies from their government to develop production in the Middle East to meet the needs of the U.S. military, which in turn would end up viewing the bulk of its needs as consisting of wars to control that oil whenever CIA coups wouldn't do the trick. Immediately after the 1945 talks at Yalta, the United States wanted to move forces from Europe to the Pacific and refuel planes in the Middle East. That need motivated President Roosevelt to meet with Mr. Saud. The agreement with Saudi Arabia regarding its oil followed. By the time a U.S. air base was built in Saudi Arabia, the Pacific War was over. But the oil companies had learned that for them, every advantage lay in talking about their work as if it was somehow in the strategic interest of the United States. Leave the word imperial out. Leave the word colonization out. Leave the word destruction or slavery out. That wouldn't wash at that time. But it was all the same. Next came the giving and selling of mountains of weapons to the dictators of the Middle East, also justified as strategic. The real explanation for the dramatic rise in such sales in the 1960s, according to Mitchell, was that the oil-rich dictators had more money than they could spend on anything else. They might have invested in improving the lives of the people of their nations, of course, but much of that spending would have flowed to third nations. With weapons, the United States could remain the sole provider, or try to, at least. It could also enrich these weapon companies. Oil companies actually opposed selling weapons to Iran and argued for ceasing to back Israeli settlements. But weapon companies won out every time. To the extent that the oil companies started this cycle of killing people with war in order to kill the planet with oil, they did so through the power of connections to weapon sales. The British Navy drove the demand for weapon Western dominance of the world's oil supply, just as the U.S. military today consumes the largest amount of oil to fight its wars everywhere. In fact, if we go back before history and ask the question of which came first, wars or the weapons with which to fight them, the answer is fairly clear. The weapons came first. They were developed for fighting lions and bears, and they were turned against humans when the lions and bears had been effectively reduced or eliminated. Intense agriculture used to feed the warriors, who would now feed themselves and provide them with their weapons, served the purpose later served by oil extraction. In conclusion, it was the military that came first. It was always the military that came first. And it is the military that pushes relentlessly to own the last word as well. End quote. Your thoughts. The power of the military to control everything. And why everyone within the official system refuses to say, as we have suggested, and as reason demands, how much should we spend to truly be safe? The highest amount I could find was $200 billion. A more reasonable and realistic amount was $50 billion. That is still five times more than Russia spends and 3.5 times more than China spends at the lowest end. So why do we spend $1.4 trillion? Because they figured out how to keep people in a perpetual state of fear, manipulating them at every level. And it's a gorging feast of special interest. And so the next time you hear Sean Hannity or someone on the left who will not oppose these military cuts or do so as fascism light, well, that's the Democrats. Whereas regular fascism, that's the Republicans. Yeah, we're willing to have some military defense cuts, but over a 10-year period at $2 trillion sounds like a lot. Well, hold on a second. That just is the amount of what would normally be an increase at 3% per year. So you're not cutting anything, not a penny in actual money. What would $1.2 trillion get us per year? Well, how about we could rebuild all the infrastructure in America, all of our bridges, dams, levees, all of the rivers could be cleaned up. All of the landfills, Superfund landfills, could be cleaned up. We could stop the acidification of the Gulf, and we could reforest the entire country state by state. We could put over 1 million people to work, and then we would still have enough money left over that we could feed every one of the 18 million hungry children, and we would still have enough money left over that we could forgive the entire interest on the debt of every student in the United States. So they weren't encumbered when they left school and didn't have a paying job or a well-paying job. They wouldn't be in debt peonage. And we would still have enough money left over that we could have single-payer coverage for those who could not be a part of a private coverage system. But that's just 1 year of what we could save if we were ever honest about how much money we give the military-industrial complex that they don't need, shouldn't have, and we continue to abide by it. And finally, from our environmental segment, if you have a chance, watch the speech that I gave before the at the Earth Day, where I was a keynote speaker. I thought it was last year. It's actually 2 years ago now. And where the room was packed, you'll see in one of the shots that there was only standing room only around the walls. And these were an awful lot of environmental groups there, and I chose to challenge them in a constructive way, but just asking, what have you done, really done, for the environment? You have big offices, multi-million-dollar budgets, you have big expense accounts, you're always the ones invited on television, always the ones that testified before Congress. You're invited to all these special junkets on the environment. But what have you actually done? Have any of you actually locked yourself, like Bill McKibben and others, around the White House to a fence, to protest anything? Have you ever been arrested? Any of you? Have you ever made any sacrifice? Ever? No. And then I went through and read how much money they got from the polluting companies that had sold their soul. And I said we should discard the entire environmental movement 100% and start all over from grassroots, which is what we have done with amazing success for those working together collectively to really stop genetic engineering of food, at least label it, to stop the spread of nuclear weapons, try to close down these plants, to challenge Hadron fracking, to challenge the whole entire fraud of the vaccination industry. And then none of this is being done by any major organization, because long ago, you will not see them in any of these events. Because I always ask, thousands of people there, 8,000 people in Washington, how many of you hear from, and I mentioned the top 30 environmental groups, not a single person. They're just regular people who care enough. So the future should only be directed by the grassroots. Here's a very short, but I think a very important voice, George Montabat from The Guardian, on what's happening this week. Because we'll be told officially that, of course, the present Congress is interested in the environment. What do you think, we're insensitive? We care about the environment. After all, those who are environmental conscious are a large voting bloc. We're sensitive to your news. We want to help stop some of the events that we can change. Really? Well, what have you done? Can you show me? We're working on it. We have a committee. I see. And you've had these committees forever? Have they ever done anything? We're getting close. All right. Here's what he says, and I'll quote this. Worn down by hope, that's the predicament of those who sought to defend the Earth's living systems. Every time governments meet to discuss the environmental crisis, we are told that this is a make-or-break summit on which the future of the world depends. The talks might have failed before, but this time, the light of reason will descend upon the world. We know it's all rubbish, but we allow our hopes to be raised only to witness 190 nations arguing through the night over the use of the subjunctive in paragraph 286. We know that at the end of this process, the UN Secretary General, whose job obliges him to talk nonsense in an impressive number of languages, will explain that the unresolved issues, how about all of them, will be settled next year, at next year's summit. Yet still we hope for something better. This week's Earth Summit in Rio is a ghost of the glad, confident meeting 20 years ago. But by now, the leaders who gathered in the same city in 1992 told us the world's environmental problems were to have been solved. Not one of them has. But all they have generated is more meetings, which will continue until the delegates, surrounded by rising waters, have eaten the last rare dove, exquisitely presented with an olive leaf. The biosphere that world leaders promised to protect us is in a far worse state than it was 20 years ago. Is it not time to recognize they have failed, all of them, consistently, and especially the Al Gore who pretends to care about the environment? These summits have failed for the same reason that the banks have failed. Political systems that are supposed to represent everyone now return governments of millionaires financed by and acting on behalf exclusively of billionaires. The past 20 years have been a billionaire's banquet. At the behest of corporations and the ultra-rich, governments have removed the constraining decencies, meaning the laws and regulations, which prevent one person from destroying another. To expect governments funded and appointed by this class to protect the biosphere and defend the poor is like expecting a lion to live on Gazpacho. You have only to see the way the United States has savaged the Earth Summit draft declaration to grasp the scale of the problem. For example, under President Obama, the word equitable, the U.S. insists, must be cleansed from every text. So must any mention of the right to food, the right to water, the right to health, the right to the rule of law, the right to gender equality, the right of women's empowerment must all be stripped out, or the United States won't touch it. And that's on the specific and direct orders of the President of the United States. Remember that. Just remember that. So must a clear target of preventing 2 degrees of global warming. So must a commitment to change, quote, unsustainable consumption and production patterns, end quote, and to decouple economic growth from the use of natural resources. Political systems that were supposed to represent everyone now return governments to who they belong to. And let us all be clear, our governments belong to those rich enough to buy them. This is the government, remember, not of George W. Bush, but of Barack Obama. The paranoid, petty, unilateral sabotage of international agreements continues uninterrupted, but smoothly. Looks nice. Talks sweet. To see Obama backtracking on the commitments made by Bush the elder 20 years ago is to see the extent to which a tiny group of plutocrats has asserted its grip on policy. In conclusion, so this is the great question of our age. Where is everyone? I ask again, where is everyone? The monster social movements of the 19th century and the first 80 years of the 20th century, they're all gone. And nothing realistically has replaced them. Oh yes, we have some people screaming, but for what? And at what outcome? Those of us who still contest unwarranted power find our footsteps echoing through the cavernous halls once thronged by multitudes. When a few hundred people do make a stand, as the Occupy campers have done, the rest of the nation just waits for them to achieve the kind of change that requires a sustained work of millions. Without mass movements, without the kind of confrontation required to revitalize democracy, everything of value is deleted from the political text. But we don't mobilize, perhaps because we are endlessly seduced by hope. Hope is the rope from which we are now hanging ourselves. End quote, George Montabaud. Your thoughts, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. I'm Gary Nall. Our guest is on standby. We're going to go to him in a moment. Time permitting after that, I will share a commentary of just what rules and laws have been changed, how they change, what they mean to us, how many are there of these, when did it start, who is responsible, and what does it foretell? All this coming to our attention. And by the way, I realize, especially the other night at our world premiere at the Ethical Culture Center, I can't tell you how many people came over afterwards. A lot of senior citizens says, thank you for having that phone that we can listen to because I can't always be home to listen on the radio, and I used to have to rush home so I could get there. And other people saying, you know, I'd go out to my car, you know, and get quiet in the parking lot during my lunch break to listen. Now the new technology allows you, if you need to be free of a radio but still want to hear the show, there's a number you can call, and at your regular phone rate, you can listen anywhere in North America. That includes Canada. Write down this number. That way you're never away from this program when you need to listen to it. 832-280-0066. 832-280-0066. I also want to thank a record number of people who downloaded this Monday evening's Progressive Commentary Hour. We should exceed 200,000 unique original downloads just of that one program just overnight. Would make it the most downloaded program in America. So people are listening and sharing, and I thank you for sharing that. Before we go to our break and come back, let me just say hello to Brad from Long Island. Brad, you're up. Your turn.
Hey, Gary, how are you? I saw you down at the New Community Cinema the last time you were there. Gary, is it possible? Of course it's possible. What are your thoughts if we were to organize some kind of, not a union, but just organize and stand up and say we don't accept illegal rulings, we don't accept certain things when politicians go to a big summit and don't do what's needed to be done. You know, we won't work with this bank. We won't work with this gas station. And so on. Okay, and we won't buy food in the status quo. We'll buy it in an alternative way. And then to have like a board or something that's, you know, online or in direct communication with people, you know, with the two-way communication.
Okay. Brad, do you remember when I came down to the theater there on, what is it, 10th Street and First Avenue?
Where Charlotte is, on Park Avenue, Charlotte's Guy.
All right. Do you remember I said, if you want to make a difference, make it personally, one-on-one, you and your conscience. Remember I said stop buying non-union made or fair trade clothing, and I showed you the labels of my clothes, my shoes and belts. I said I only wear what's made in the USA or made by a labor that has made a living, and I said you won't see me doing business with them. I won't eat their food. I won't watch their television. I won't support them politically. I'll vote for a third party candidate, though I don't endorse any given one. I said, you've got to withdraw yourself from them. Then you'll find a coalition. Now, remember I said that every single day, 7 days a week, we have scholars on our staff that all they do is look for issues in some 40 different categories to get over 100 different articles per 24-hour cycle, more than the Huffington Post. More than any of these others that empower you, because they're from a progressive point of view, meaning finding solutions. So we're doing that. We just don't need a board of directors to do it. We don't need a local station board meeting where they each go in with a fork and stab each other in the eye for the entire meeting and say they've done something constructive. Yeah, you've created a redundant blindness. That's not constructive. It's you who has the power of yourself. You don't need anyone to tell you to do it, show you how to do it. All you have to do is know you can do it. That's what we're about. That's why these movies exist. And that's why we are going forward. That's why there are people from Woodstock who came to the meeting and said, would you come back to Woodstock and do another lecture on public television and show the movie? I said, you bet. So in July, I'll be back on Woodstock. It's happening all over the United States. It's happening everywhere, and it's under their radars because they're used to only a certain group of people protesting. But remember, there'll be a blowback on that, and that's why I'm going to do a commentary either today or tomorrow, depending upon time. But thank you, Brad.
Thanks, Gary.
Thank you for bringing that once again to our attention. I appreciate it. I'm opposed to any law that stops an individual because they look suspicious and you feel as you are a police or a mayor or a police commissioner, that you have the right to militarize those police officers so they can in turn search and frisk another human being. I am opposed to it, but I'm not alone. Colombo's also opposed to it as well.
This is Lieutenant Colombo, here to share with you some thoughts on something that really bothers me. Did you know that in New York City, over a million citizens, minding their own business, not doing anything wrong, are stopped and frisked each year by the NYPD? This is something I don't understand. I mean, in all my years as a detective, I played by the rules, never violating anyone's civil rights, and I always got my man. And we're talking about real crime, murder, not Mickey Mouse wee crap. That's why I can't figure out why so many of my fellow police officers out there would demean their badge by engaging in such racist and illegal activity. Now, I know a lot of you officers don't like participating in this kind of criminal behavior. You say, hey, I'm just following orders. Well, we've heard that line before, haven't we? I wouldn't go there. Just because the mayor and the commissioner like to break the law doesn't mean that you have to go along for the ride. It gives the whole force a black eye. And how would you like it if it happened to your kid? Let me be blunt. It's time to stand up to the boss and just say no to stop and frisk. And I mean it. For Bloomberg, he's a very disturbed man with a Napoleonic complex, turning New York City into an out-of-control police state. It's time for him to go. I say ship his ass off to The Hague and make this city safe for democracy. Well, That's it for now. Thank you, and God bless. Oh, one more thing. See you on Father's Day on that silent march down Fifth Avenue with the Harlem 33.
So I'm absolutely opposed to all those stop and frisks or profiling of any type, and I believe that as a society we should say no, even if we are not of the type that's likely to be stopped and frisked. My guest is on, but I promised today I would start by each day spending a little time either reading something or having someone on that shows you that we have to change the way that we treat this. Now, I have an in-depth commentary I will do tomorrow on Has Drug-Driven Medicine Become a Form of Human Sacrifice? This is from Whitefeather. Hello, Gary. Thanks for the new documentary. After watching the film and having Father's Day without our father for the past 29 years, here in brief is the story which would I would appreciate your thoughts on. Our beloved went into hospital in New York City for a simple procedure, told he would be home in 3 to 4 days. He died there. When my mom called to tell me he died, she said my two sisters stepped out of the room. When they returned, he had passed. He choked on his vomit. Recently, when we spoke about after her receiving $15,000 bill from the hospital, that said that he died from complications from renal surgery. This occurred 4 months ago, and I'm wondering if there is any recourse I can take. My dad did not have to die. There were no symptoms. There was no tumor found in his kidney during routine examination and x-rays. I personally cautioned him against going, as he told me he felt fine. No symptoms, but the doctor told him that he wanted to go in just to be sure, and he was going to go into Mount Sinai for a laparoscopy and, quote, using the latest technique. He came out of it fine, started to eat, food would not stay down, could not catch his breath. Chest x-ray said he was fine and good enough to go home. He was asked if they could do an experiment on him prior to surgery, asking him many detailed questions, interviewing him pre- and post-op to check out his recall. This man was loved by many, father of four, my brother and me included, grandfather and grandmother also. A World War II veteran, volunteered at the VA hospital regularly, Knights of Columbus, volunteered delivering meals on wheels, volunteered every Friday at the bingo hall supporting many children other than his biological ones. He, in my opinion, was healthy for a man his age, never complained, drove a car. In fact, he washed the kitchen floor before he went into the hospital. Gary, what do you think? How dare they take the life of a vital man who contributed to his community, who wanted to live? He was not sick. I can see if he was disabled or ill, but this was simply not the case. So there you go. Let me know. All the best and enjoy life. Whitefeather. Whitefeather, unfortunately, your father was a victim, like nearly 600 to a million people each year, whose lives are ended because of medical mistakes, decisions in the hospital. We cannot change the system. It is not changeable. They have all the power, but you have the power to become educated on iatrogenic episodes, the number one cause of death in America, exceeding heart attack, stroke, or cancer. Also, the injuries they cause are in the tens of millions. You would think if you're killing nearly a million Americans, injuring about 30 million, that someone would find that of interest. But no one does, because once you open that door, you understand that there'll be a lot of us, experts in the field who have it documented using their statistics, who will make it an issue. So rather than making any issue, when 7,000 copies of a multi-award-winning documentary and a full book detailing this called Death by Medicine was sent to every major media, every major medical organization, every member of Congress, every governor, every one of the state 50 legislators in all 50 states, over 5,000 people, all told, over 12,000 people received this. Not a single person responded. Not one. That is a fear of knowing. So look first at your father's experience. A, I see you do have a class act, or you have an action there, but join others in a class action. You'll have greater power on that. But we have to educate each other. Get people to watch together. Get a little group of 5 or 10 or 20 and watch Death by Medicine and see how many people can relate to it. And then look at what you can do to prevent these illnesses. And once you hear my commentary tomorrow about why we have to stop supporting the paradigm that does not support us. With the exception of emergency medicine, it is the most deadly thing we could have done to ourselves. All right? More on this tomorrow. But I'm going to go to my guest now, who's standing by. I gave you his bio earlier in the program. He also co-hosts Robert Scott Bell's program on health and has been published in L.A. City Beat and New York Press. He is Liam Sheff. Nice to have you with us today.
Hey, Gary. How you doing?
Good. Good luck on your new book, Official Stories.
Yeah, thank you.
Which looks at the official stories of events in science that have become mainstream beliefs, albeit unfounded by facts, evidence, or new science. Because you have so many, let's take one as an example of how we're given an official story that everyone lines up in support of that official story, and then if you challenge it, no matter what evidence or proof you have to the contrary, you are not given any responsible input. So you decide, tell me which one you'd like to start with today, and we'll just do one.
Well, the book is, a few years ago I had investigated all the AIDS stuff and figured out what that was about. I was investigating vaccination. I figured out what that was about. And then I looked at 9/11, which was hard to look at. It was painful to look at. And then I realized what that was about. And it occurred to me that any time there's an official story, it's not true. And that seemed funny to me. It struck a chord. And I sat and I was at my desk and I said, why is it that every official version is not true? Is it a lie? Is it a cover? Who writes official stories? Oh, the officials write official stories, I said. Oh, okay, official stories, and then that's the tagline for the book. Official stories exist to protect officials. It's like a syllogism. It finishes itself. And let's see, I've been doing investigative journalism since 2002, so it's 10 years. And I collected all the stuff that's really these big, juicy items. So from CIA, JFK, 9/11, vaccination, even Big Bang Theory, even these sciences that were taught. Darwinism is not a science. You can't do science with survival of the fittest. You can't evolve anything into a cell by saying fit things survive. So we live in this cloud of, recycled myth, essentially recycled myth. Like Big Bang Theory is a recycled myth. It's the myth of Genesis. First there was nothing which exploded. There's better science out there to talk about the universe called plasma physics. But in the 10 minutes maybe or so that we have, let's just burn through 9/11. That's the official story that got us to where it's what you were talking about in the first half of the show, talking about the military-industrial complex and their trillion-dollar budgets. So I'll throw that to you. Let's look at the official story of 9/11.
Okay, well, the idea is you have many stories. We're only going to do 9/11 today. We'll do each of the others on subsequent shows. But take us through the official story in summary, which most people know, and then show us how that official story is fully and completely deconstructed and why no one, left or right, from Keith Olbermann, Rachel Maddow on the left, and Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity on the right, no one's willing to go against the official story. So take us there now.
Thank you. Yeah, each chapter starts with the same thing. Every official story has three planks. The story, the myth that they tell you, 19 Arabs who hated America and hated freedom under direction from Osama bin Laden, the guy in a cave in Afghanistan, managed to infiltrate America, the air system, shut down the military, and pilot two planes into two targets in New York City, thus making three of them. That's what I said. Three of them fall down at free fall speed. There's always a lone gunman. You always blame somebody. It's always outside of the group. The Greeks used to call it scapegoating or ostracizing from ostraki. They would actually break a vase and have the little pieces, and they'd get rid of one person who got the bad piece. And there's always the magic bullet. Every official story has to have a magic bullet, something so wildly incomprehensible. For JFK, it's the magic bullet, one bullet that causes seven wounds over 2 seconds and two people over shifting planes. For 9/11, the magic bullet is just the visual of it. I mean, they destroy. You have planes bursting into fireballs 90 stories in the air, and it's just shocking. It's no irony that right after 9/11, the military adventure that we were told that we had to go on was called shock and awe. I mean, that's what they did to us. That's the irony. They shocked us. They awed us. It was like a Michael Bay movie, except really in downtown Manhattan or in Wall Street. So what the official story is the one I just told you. The reality is you just scratch the surface, and this is how the book proceeds. Scratch the surface. Immediately, you've got 15 of the hijackers are from Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia. Did we attack Saudi Arabia? Totalitarian oil dictatorship? No, they're our best friend. Why? Because we use oil. So that's you already understand that. Scratch the surface again. You see that they weren't able to fly the planes. That's right. The guys who were supposed to stunt pilot these planes in loop-de-loos, 270-degree barrel turns, flying over Washington, D.C., back into the Pentagon, weren't able to do it. They flunked out of pilot school with single-engine small planes. And that's on the record. And by the way, nothing I say in the book, Official Stories, is not on the record. I mean, this is just major news reporting. Scratch again. You get into the Twin Towers, the giant buildings that used to live in Wall Street. These things were made of steel, not paper mache. They went away at free fall speed. They didn't collapse. That's a word game that we use because when you blow something up, the debris falls to the ground. What happened was, and you have to watch the video, this is the hard part. It was hard for me. I couldn't do it until 2007. You have to watch the video to see, but these buildings explode outward. And you can tell that because 4-ton girders are thrown through the air like handfuls of toothpicks outward. Outward. They embed in buildings across a football field away, across the street. Now, that's the official story was there was an accident that happened and somehow we didn't see the 19, what, Afghanis, Arabs, who managed to, what, get the entire North American air grid to stand down? And the reality is just what I described, and it builds from there. And there are about 100 good pieces of evidence. Nanothermite, unexploded thermite found around the WTC. Building 7. The command center for Secret Service, IRS, CIA, FBI in New York City comes down in 6.5 seconds. The guy who owns the lease, Larry Silverstein, with strong Zionist connections, sorry if that bugs you. Hey, I'm not anti-Israel, anti-Jewish, but I got to say it the way it is, says that he gave the order to pull it. Well, then he tells you that pull it doesn't mean what it means, which is to have the building, which is pre-loaded with explosives, come down. Well, you can watch the video of Building 7 come down. More interesting, here's my favorite bit. The Vice President and the President of the United States, who happened to both be on a little think tank committee called Project for a New American Century at the end of the 90s and early 2000s, who signed a charter paper saying the only way to get it, we have to go into the Middle East and remake all of Middle Eastern policy because we need oil. They say it, are called in by the 9/11 Commission, which they took a year and a quarter to even allow to exist, and then they refused to appear separately, and they refused to appear under oath. Hey, let me tell you something, Gary. I don't know about you, but that tells me something.
Continue on. And if we're coming up in about 2 minutes at the end of this segment of our program for many of our land-based stations, we'll be continuing for an additional 5 minutes. I was going to have Lou Anne Panessi on today, but we won't have time. She'll be reading your mail tomorrow. But you can call a number if you're listening on a regular radio and you have no other access to continuing to listen to the program. Call on your telephone and listen, 832-280-0066, 832-280-0066, or you can go over to the Internet and continue listening on the Internet. So please continue, but take us through what you found, the official story said, and then the truth. And ask yourself this, why would the President of the United States be afraid to testify under oath? Why? What would he be afraid of?
The answer is why, when the teacher asked you if you threw the spitball or the bubblegum at somebody, did you clam up and not say anything rather than lie? It's hard to tell a lie publicly. It's easy to see through it. George Bush told Jr. told a lot of lies publicly, and he stuttered and he stammered, and he made those malapropisms. I know how hard it is to put food on a family, you know, whatever it was called when he landed on the aircraft carrier, you know, Operation Success or some such thing. Now the book starts out with somebody I call Captain America in chapter one, Smedley Butler, and it does so to lay the groundwork. Maybe we'll do this another time. But then you go through CIA. This isn't a shot in the dark. This isn't a one-time thing. When you understand that the United States government is, in effect, de facto, owned and operated by clandestine services, clandestine services which wage war overseas with our tax dollars, in our name, without our knowledge. These wars are not reported in the press. They're reported in blacked-out FOIA documents a few years later. But if you want, you can go to the Wikipedia and find 70 or 80 clandestine CIA wars that have been started overseas. Now, I don't blame the U.S. government for 9/11, but I will tell you one interesting thing, because I blame infiltrators. I blame what I call the jackals who live inside of all of this stuff. And they claim every national identity. And, Gary, you understand that they have no national identity. They're simply going where the money will flow. The Bush family has bought large tracts of land in Paraguay. This is on the record. This is well-reported and well-documented. You can ask yourself what that means. I think it means they realize that the American experiment is over. They've duped the American people for this century, and they're not going to be able to get much more out of us than they can get out of China, which is essentially a nation of slave working zombies, Walmart zombies, eating genetically modified, I don't know, putrid food. So what else happened on 9/11 that's interesting? There were the buildings. There was the Pentagon. Pentagon's interesting. There was Shanksville. Well, the people in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, were on the ground, said, it sounded like there was somebody shot something out of the sky. We heard a number of airplanes. It sounded like interceptors. Now, you have to ask yourself, where was the U.S. military? Because I know that young guys in the military sign up, and I'll put this bluntly, to kick ass. They sign up to kill bad guys. You can't get the military to stand down unless, well, what happened? Here's the interesting tidbit, the most interesting tidbit. There's a company called P-TECH. P-TECH is a Saudi-owned company. They had their computer software called Promise Software, P-R-O-M-I-S, software, daisy-chained and hooked into which computer system? That would be our Federal Aviation Administration. That's right, our FAA was sharing and doubling information with a Saudi company called P-TECH. The day after 9/11, that company and the founder of that company, Yassine Al-Qadi, was called a suspect terrorist. He was put on the 9/11 terrorist watch list, not in the country anymore. How did this happen? How was Carnivore replicating software daisy-chained into the network? Now, you can ask yourself this, but the answer is because they planned it. It's not that complicated. I don't know who all the they are. I don't have that kind of access. I can tell you that Dick Cheney wouldn't appear under oath. I can tell you that Norman Mineta, Secretary of Transportation, said Dick Cheney was in the bunker watching. He said this on record at the 9/11 Commission testimony, and it was blotted out. Thank God some people saved it on TiVo and put it back up. Norman Mineta, congressman, I believe, I want to say from California, said that Dick Cheney watched the plane approaching the bunker. He was approached by a young man who said the plane is 30 miles out, 20 miles out, 10 miles out. Here's the question. Did the order still stand? According to Congressman Norman Mineta, Dick Cheney swung around and said, of course the orders still stand. Have you heard anything to the contrary? What happened? The plane hit the Pentagon, or whatever hit the Pentagon. Now, where was the military on this day? Here's a funny piece of information, because the military would have intercepted these planes and blown them out of the sky, like they did in Shanksville. Believe me, that's what happened. That's what all evidence points to anyway. What happened was there were probably five simulations clogging up the radar, diverting planes over the Atlantic and into Canada. These are called war games, but game is the wrong word. They are actually tactical, complex simulations. There was one scheduled for New York City. Guess what day? For Tuesday, September 11th, 2001. So that it was called, I believe, Tripod 2. It doesn't matter. But there was an entire arm of military there, FEMA, I should say, there in New York, ready to do chemical explosions, a chemical contamination drill. What day? The day that asbestos was blown all over lower Manhattan. Sound like a coincidence? Well, you got a better tolerance for coincidence than I do. The answer is because they planned it. And they planned it for the exact reasons you were talking about in the beginning of the show. Because Americans in general, don't really have that much of an appetite to send teenagers overseas to get blown up and to blow up young children, women, and Arab families. We don't actually long for this. You've got to dement our vision enough to convince us that this is somehow justice. And this is the point. Remember, the purpose of any act or conspiracy is the outcome. And the outcome is where we're living. Two or three giant bank bailouts, bailouts of giant American corporations which were going bankrupt, disappearance of the Enron cases and the WorldCom stuff which went down in WTC7, and a military that can receive as much money as it wants to because we're constantly on alert. Last thing I'll say is I went through airport security in Chicago the other day, and you could have just put brown shirts on these guys. And I mean that in the German sense, because they didn't respect any citizen. I had to tell a couple of them that they weren't police. They couldn't take my stuff. They couldn't separate me from my stuff. They laughed at me. And finally, they relented and brought my stuff with me. I had picked up a toothbrush that was left on the conveyor belt, and I said, "Hey, this must have fallen out of some," and I was yelled at, "Don't touch that." It's a freaking toothbrush, you know? It wasn't a toothbrush, and I hate to break it to you, but it wasn't box cutters and plastic forks that brought down the Twin Towers.
Liam, thank you for being on. I appreciate you sharing these insights. My guest, Liam Sheff, S-C-H-E-F-F. He is an award-winning investigative journalist, a researcher, addressing the medical cult and politics of the official stories. And what he does, he uses their official stories, but then he refutes them by showing the truth around these myths they have created. And for those who are looking for the truth, his newest work is important on this. So let us take a look at what we've been told and measured against something. Official Stories is the book. His website is ReduceTheBurden.org or Liam Sheff, LiamSchEff.com. All the best to you. We look forward to our next discussion.
Thanks
Gary
so
Null. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back tomorrow with another program.